Hello, and welcome to the Velvet Studio on 93.1 CKCU. We are still getting organized. There's some crossover going on here. Anyway, so hello and welcome. So today we have a guest, a special guest from CAPSA. How about you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Karen James, and so I'm on the board of directors for CAPSA, and I've been with them for about the last 3 years. And, of course, we're focused on improving the face of people with addiction to the face of people in recovery.
Okay, so before we get started on anything, whenever we get a guest in from an organization, I always like to ask about the organization before we talk about the issues. So, oh, also Jake is here. Hello, Jake. Oh, wait, your mic isn't on. Here.
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Yeah, I think it's on.
There you go. That's better. Sorry about that.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Just forget about me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That happens. Okay, so what does CAPSA stand for?
It's a Community Addiction Peer Support Association.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was to really activate the recovering community, getting them to come together and sort of advocate for themselves and
right.
give a picture of recovery rather than the picture we commonly see on the news, which is the addicted individual and all the horrible things that comes with that. We wanted to show a positive image of people in recovery because people, in fact, do recover.
Yes. Well, ideally. It's a... Well, okay, so I've known a few people who've recovered from many things, and there's the old story that you're never truly recovered. You're just better at not being an addict anymore. What kind of approach does CAPSA use that makes it different from other organizations?
Well, again, I think that we tried to take a position that really wanted to focus on recovery itself.
Right.
And the fact that people not only enter recovery, but they change themselves pretty dramatically, and they become responsible and productive members of society, and that we give back an awful lot. One of the things that people are not aware of, for instance, in the peer support world, we do a lot of volunteer hours that go beyond most other volunteer organizations. So the average individual involved, say, in a helping area, helping another peer, may be giving 5 to 6 or more hours a week volunteer to helping other people. That's a bit different from the average organization that has volunteers. It was built into sort of the society of recovery
mm-hmm.
that we gave back and that we helped each other. So it's a very strong peer support world, and we really wanted to get the average individual out there to see us. We do amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
We are really healthy people, and there are many of us. I'm in recovery myself, so I have 24 years of recovery. I would call myself recovered.
Okay.
I would not say that, no, I'm still recovering. I would say, no, I have recovered.
Excellent.
And I'm still part of a peer group that mm-hmm. gives back to other people.
Actually, it kind of, I don't know why this jumped in there, but it sounds a bit like almost like a dojo in a sense. Like you have your instructor mm-hmm. and then your senior students are helping your middle students and the middle students are helping the younger students. And so it's more of a flow instead of like some central, you know, psychotherapist in the middle of a room and everybody is getting sort of group therapy with them. It seems to be a little bit more networky.
Well, and it's more about, if I know how to get healthier and I find that way, I can help the next person behind me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can, and each of us is different. So somebody might find me easier to be with and work with and understand, and somebody may find someone else. So
right.
there are different characteristics in people, and they're drawn to different people.
Right.
But the biggest defining feature is we've all experienced this, and so we all have something that we can offer people to show them how to get better.
Right. Oh, okay. I mean, it's a good idea to have a whole cluster of counselors like that. Well, not counselors, but people helping you anyway, because, I mean, as you said, like, your personalities might be different, but it could also be that the kinds of solutions that work for one person won't work for another. And if you have a whole room full of people with a whole room full of solutions, you're bound to strike upon one that works for you.
Yeah, and we're seeing more variety now in the type of self-help groups that are available.
Mm-hmm.
So they've expanded beyond the 12-step model, and there are other models now. There's Smart Recovery.
Yeah.
We also put on a group called All People, All Pathways,
mm-hmm.
which is a very different style of group. It's an interactive discussion and a learning process. We teach people about addiction so they can represent themselves in a way that gives them dignity, because too often addiction has been associated with a lack of dignity or with some really despairing comments, and we don't want people to have to live that way.
Right.
Addiction isn't something to feel ashamed about. Like anything else, it is a problem that people develop for specific reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other illnesses that would fit under that same description, but they're not treated as despairingly as addiction.
Yeah. So sort of the, you know, it's a bad solution to a reasonable problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just as overeating can be a bad solution to a reasonable problem, just as eating improperly and becoming diabetic can be an improper solution to a problem.
Right,
so there's many ways in which we do things that don't help us.
Okay.
And addiction is just one.
So, you mentioned the 12-step program earlier, I know that traditionally that is faith-based. Is CAPS a secular, or is it...
I'm not going to comment on the 12-step, because that really is an anonymous program, and I don't have the right to comment on it at all.
Right, yeah.
But CAPSA is not taking any position such as that. We're trying to be inclusive of all people and all pathways to recovery, hence why we called our meeting All People, All Pathways. We accept all pathways. We do not endorse one particular path over another. We endorse what works for people.
Okay. This is very exciting. I like this. All right, so I guess just a couple more questions, and then we'll go on break, and then we'll come back with some more. Do you know anything about the history of the organization? Like, how old is it? How long has it been around? Is it just Ottawa? We have listeners, actually, on the East Coast and the West Coast as well. Mm-hmm. Are there any mirror organizations?
Well, I think CAPSA, it started about 3 years ago.
Okay.
And that's when I certainly joined at the very beginning of it. But, you know, if we look down to the states, they've been a great model for what we're trying to do here in Ottawa. The Americans seem to get it.
Okay.
And they've done some amazing things. So they've unified the recovering community. They've created community centers where people can go and become active in a number of ways, either in their own recovery or they can be looking for a job and getting skills, all sorts of things. So community center dedicated just to people in recovery, and really revitalized the recovering community and got them up and active and got them proud of themselves and what they're doing, got them involved with the community as a whole, created a presence that was respected and understood. We want to replicate that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of our previous chairperson went down to Philadelphia and actually attended the training down there for peer coach support, because we also want to be able to do something like that, provide actually an educated peer group, actually trained to support people, and then align them with the existing addiction organizations, so we carry them through from the wait list right through their recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big hole and a big gap in services in Ottawa right now. And I know the agencies will be rather thrilled to have that being offered. So that's a project we're in the process of working on. But it began with Dan Rathwell originally, and then Jason Miller, and then our current person that's heading it is Kim Brown.
Okay.
So we've changed over time, but the flavor and the ideas behind it have remained the same.
So part of the recovery process is teaching people how to help other people going through the recovery process.
Well, it would be ideally better if we taught people rather than they just fly by the seat of their pants.
Well.
So if we teach them, we can teach them with the right methods of how to help somebody, how to intervene, how to support in a way that's healthy, not unhealthy, because left alone, you don't really know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to provide them with an education that makes them competent peer support people.
Right.
And recognized as peer support people, acknowledged by other agencies, and seen as a viable force supporting people in recovery.
All right. That's a really good backgrounder. Okay, so we're going to go to our first song, and while we're on break, Jake is going to come in here, and then we're going to chat.
For sure. A little bit more, probably.
For those listening, we may have mentioned it before, but one of the main reasons why we play music on a chat show is we usually the music breaks to discuss what we're going to do next sometimes. And sometimes we do it just because we're having technical difficulties and the board is frustrating, but we can get the music to play. Anyway, no comment as to what is going on right now that I'm like, we need a music right now. Anyway, okay. So, I don't know why, but today I just felt like playing folk rock, because I like folk rock, and yes, and I was trying to, anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, so this is a Toronto band called The Hidden Cameras. We've played them before, and this is A Miracle, and we'll be right back after this. I definitely did turn on Jake's microphone this time. So we're back. Again, this is the Velvet Studio. You're listening to Sebastian. Jake is here and our guest Karen. Okay. So now I want to give this more of the sort of queer spin, because, I mean, that is what the Velvet Studio is all about. The kinds of addictions that are more common in the community, the kinds of things that may lead to them, the unique struggles about recovering from addictions within the queer community, that sort of thing. So first, I guess, do you know much about what kinds of addictions are more common?
I think that, you know, when you're looking at trauma, for instance, and I would look at this community and say they've been traumatized historically. Mm-hmm. So they've had certainly a lot of adversity to face. Mm-hmm. And that can set people up for things like an opiate addiction. That's a very common one that people use to deal with trauma.
Okay.
And but another larger one is, where is the most common meeting places for this community? Well, those places are typically bars.
Yeah.
So again, if you're looking at the bar scene, you're going to see a lot of alcohol use, mm-hmm. probably some cocaine or methamphetamine use, because that also goes with that particular environment. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest challenges facing this group of people is that, where are the environments that are safe for them to be together and not have a drug or alcohol as a focus,
right,
or as part of that community. And we find it hard for just the recovering community, period, to mm-hmm. find places. But when a community of people normally meet in bars,
yeah,
that is the common mm-hmm. ground, that's very difficult, I think.
Yeah.
It adds a whole new challenge all by itself.
And there are historical reasons why that was. I mean, in the sort of 50s and 60s, where it was way more taboo, bars were an easy environment to control.
Yeah.
The bar owner could get, the doorman, and they could set up a place, and, you know, it was more common back then to turn away people at the door because you weren't the kind of person they were looking for in that place. And not, I mean, there probably was a lot of sexism and racism, but that's not necessarily what it was. You know, this was a gentleman's club. This was a biker's bar. They were trying to go for a feel. They were trying to go for an environment. And because it was easier to control the space, having a gay bar was much easier than having like a gay juice house or something like that. Because I know that the beatniks were really big into that, coffee houses and juice bars and keeping it dry, and then going out in the back alley and smoking weed anyway, because they were beatniks.
We found that, like, with trying to find open mics and stuff in the city for people, and it will attract drug dealers. Unfortunately, I've been in ones where eventually the dealers show up,
mm-hmm.
and then the place becomes unsafe. So, again, you know, it's hard to find safe environments. But I just want to mention a little bit about the historical background for the particular community we're discussing, and that's the trauma background. And, you know, when you're looking at what's one of the key origins of addiction, in the research right now,
mm-hmm.
We're clearly hearing through what's called the ACE studies, A-C-E, which
okay.
stands for Adverse Childhood Event Studies, that these correlate strongly with addiction. And, you know, so when you have a group of people who have been treated as poorly as they have been by communities, you've got a lot of trauma. Even their own families at times have been, you know, certainly very negative with them. And these are the underlying causes of why people become addicted. The drug or alcohol use makes them feel better.
Yeah.
You know, they don't feel good to start with because they've lived in a lot of negativity coming from all sorts of ways and all types of abuse. And this is common across all people with addiction. But, of course, in the groups where trauma has been prevalent,
mm-hmm.
you're going to see a higher number of people impacted.
Right, okay.
And that goes across many different communities.
And it's usually, like, third hand, I would guess. I mean, it's not you drink or you smoke because you had a bad childhood, but you had a bad childhood which made you anxious, and mm-hmm. anxiety is bad, and so smoking helps with yeah. the anxiety. And it's not you smoke because you had a bad parent or something like that.
You try it. And I mean, it was the same for myself. I have a traumatic background. So I tried alcohol first, and for once in my life, the level of anxiety and self-hatred lowered a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, oh, okay, this is a little bit better. You know, and I didn't make the connection really clearly, but I knew I felt better. So mm-hmm. I was attracted to doing that again. And then before you know it, I found other things that worked even better. Well, this is even better now.
Mm-hmm.
Never understanding that I was medicating anything, only that I felt better.
Right.
I was looking to feel better.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the same with most substance abuses, or even like alcohol or tobacco or marijuana or cocaine. It always comes down to a psychological feel where you makes you feel better and like avoid your problems for a period of time, which makes it very, I guess, tempting for most marginalized communities who feel left out or trying to get a feel of what's out there, kind of exploring. And I think that's also why in the queer community we have such high numbers, because everyone experienced some kind of discrimination or mm-hmm. traumatic experiences in their lives.
It's actually interesting that you mention feeling left out, because one of the problems with addictions is many of addictions are very including. So multiple times, in case you didn't know, because I know I've mentioned it once or twice, I have moved overseas. And when I lived overseas, I noticed very quickly that the other expats, or really expats are just white immigrants. I mean, expat is a weird term, but anyway, the ones who smoked made friends faster.
Yes.
All you had to do is pretend you forgot your lighter, go up to a stranger, and say, I have a smoke. I'm not bumming off of you, but can I borrow your light? And then you've made a friend. Mm-hmm. And within the queer community, I've met a lot of people who they've done really strange things. Like, I've heard of people trying meth because that allowed them to get invited to a house party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much.
And so it's, I mean, the inclusivity is also kind of a, I mean, it's very problematic because you should be able to just say to somebody, no, I'm not going to do that, but I am willing to tag along. But it doesn't always work out that way.
Well, I think it also comes when drugs come with like a sense of exclusiveness. When you do drugs, some people feel like it kind of creates like a prejudice, a barrier between them and others. So like when the others try to become the one, they try to imitate what the one does. And that makes them feel, I don't know, cooler or become the part of the other group. So, you know, when you, for example, if a gay guy was tempted to do meth at a gay party just to get invited back to this jock house, it kind of makes sense because he feels like if he does it, he's kind of more like closer to the type that he's interested in, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's assimilation with the other type.
You see this in schools too. So mm-hmm. I was working with youth in high schools, and very typically, if you don't fit in with the popular crowd, all you have to do is use a substance and you belong real quick. Mm. I mean, I used that myself when I was younger. The minute I began to use, I had a group of people to belong to. Prior to that, I was isolated.
Indeed. I remember I grew up in Asia, and when I was in high school, the first time I tried smoking, I wasn't feeling particularly down or, like, troubling. It's just like a friend gave me one, and it's a thing to do there.
Mm-hmm.
And, when in high school, we aren't allowed to smoke yet, so it's kind of like you're kind of part of this pack. It's like when you have a pack, you're a little bit more separated but more together with a bigger pie, with a smaller pie in a bigger pie, you know.
And if you're disinhibited by the drug, alcohol is great because if you're shy, you have a drink and mm-hmm. suddenly you're not shy.
Yeah. I think this also actually kind of makes me think of another very important related conversation, which is the difference between doing a mind-altering substance and feeding an addiction. So I know that in many traditional cultures, very many sort of pre-industrial cultures, this is still true actually even in Mexico to this day. It's considered to be healthy, normal adult activity once a year to go into the mountains and just blast your mind out on mushrooms. Once a year, maybe twice if it's a bad year. And more than that is a problem. Less than that, and you're doing yourself a disservice. And so it's sort of the idea that there is such a thing as a healthy way to do drugs or a healthy way to do mind-altering substances. Because, I mean, caffeine is a mind-altering substance. I mean, jogging is a mind-altering substance. Well, mind-altering activity, but whatever. So where does doing a substance end and having an addiction begin?
So there are a lot of people that use recreationally, and that's fine. That's a totally different story. I used to always say I could tell the difference by this. If I was in a bar
mm-hmm.
and I saw someone at another table and they got up and left half a drink,
yeah,
they were not really seriously into drinking. Because you never leave half a... I would be amazed. I thought, wow, how could they do that?
Right.
I had no understanding of that. That had to be drank. You just don't leave that there. So very different orientation towards the drug.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the difference is that when people are using recreationally, they're just using to have a bit of fun.
Right.
When people are using addictively, they're using because something is missing.
Right.
And that drug is helping. And they don't know any other way to help the problem. They may not even know what the problem is. But they know when they use that drug, they feel better.
That's an interesting metric. I kind of like that. Because, I mean, if you can say, there's a huge party on the weekend, 5,000 people, you know, you're going out with a group of friends, and some of you are going to roll, but you're like, but I have to work on Monday. So I'm going to do a little bit less. Then that probably means you have a healthy relationship with the substance.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Because tons of people recreationally use drugs. It's not, and alcohol.
Yeah.
It's not everybody becomes addicted.
Super common.
Well, yeah. Some people. I feel like most people who use anything like marijuana or cocaine for recreational purposes. I would say they use it more for like the feel, like depending on what purpose it is that you use it for, that you can call out like whether it's addiction or recreational. For example, if you are using it medically for pain or something like that, it's more for the purpose of that pain relief. So it's more like, it's not for addiction. But then when you use it constantly to replace, for some lonely feeling or some insomnia, it could be a little bit more to an addiction side. So it depends on, like, what purpose it is used for, I would say.
Yes. Yeah.
It depends.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're having, like, weirdly, like, I don't know. I don't know you guys.
Okay, well, so part of the story here is I used to be a bartender. And something that I've noticed, speaking with other current and former bartenders, is that they tend to be divided mostly on the same group as myself, where being a bartender makes you drink less. And being a bartender makes you more hesitant to do a lot of substances because you've seen people at their worst. It's very interesting when it's 2 a.m. and you're trying to put up chairs and wipe down the tables, and there's somebody who you only gave them 4 drinks, and they are acting way more something than 4 drinks would merit. And they were on something at the time, and you're just watching them thinking, is that me? Do I look like that? And so a lot of ex-bartenders, and I guarantee there's somebody listening right now who's like, yeah, absolutely. You go to a party and everyone's got a beer and you've got like, you have like one, maybe two, because you don't want to be that guy or that lady. And you also have this sort of instinct because you used to be in that environment of like, I never drink so much that I can't take care of myself and at least one other person, because I've been in the instance before where I couldn't, and that's not fun. And so holding back, and it's just, I don't know. I mean, my relationship with addiction is the opposite, where I'm petrified of it because I've seen the worst of it, which actually in a way is also an unhealthy relationship with substances on its own. It's probably less destructive, but it's also not exactly productive either. I guess.
So you're trying to avoid things because you don't want to get addicted to it.
Yeah, well, that's when you were looking at me, you're like, what was that look about? And that's what that look was about, because I'm always like, oh. I mean, at my worst, I smoked a pack and a half of cigarettes in a year. I mean, I'm very, very slow moving when it comes to this sort of thing.
I'd like to also point out, and I think it's important to say this, that we live in a world where this is a part of our lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it's really advertised and promoted. But I'd like you to know that for somebody such as myself, I don't use substances. I do not need to use substances. I am not missing anything. I have no desire to use those substances. My life is really, really good. As it is, I found great joy in other areas of my life. I do not feel deprived. I go to concerts. I go to the Blues Fest. And I've had people offer me. And you know what I say? You know what? I did far too much of that in one lifetime. I'm not really interested. And I'm just going to enjoy the show myself. So I don't feel the need at all. It doesn't even interest me. There's nothing there it can give me. Because what I have in my life today, living a really healthy and good life, surpasses anything that I got from using.
And even if you did, I mean, mentioning culture, I mean, and the culture of using, there's very little room for the idea of modesty, that if you're going to do it, you should do it, When I lived overseas, I had a whole bunch of British roommates, and, well, Britain is a whole bunch of places. I had roommates from Northern England, and they felt very strongly that if you drank so much you blacked out, you must have had a good time. And, of course, all the Canadians were like, that is the most messed up thing I've ever heard in my life. How do you know if you had... Like, it would be better to have a good time and remember that you had a good time. But it's this go big or go home feeling, the sort of... The drinking version of the American dream, where you reach for the stars or you don't even bother. And I don't know. There's no room for modesty and pacing and taking your time. And I don't know if...
But also the notion that is the only way to enjoy oneself, or, as you mentioned earlier, the only sort of mind enhancement that you can do has to be with a drug.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite short-sighted when mm-hmm. you think about it, because the mind is incredible.
Yes.
So you can do an awful lot of things with just your mind.
Yeah.
You don't need to do a psychedelic drug in order to have a profound experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we shortchange ourselves
when
we think this is the only way to enjoy ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think we really, really shortchange ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely... it's a different kind of experience, that's for sure. I mean, I remember when I was younger and I used to go to the club almost every weekend. And I never drank because I was a bad dancer when I drank. And I didn't smoke because it was bad on your lungs and you were a bad dancer when you smoked. And I didn't do drugs, partly because I was cheap and partly because I didn't know that many dealers anyway. But I still got high as balls because all you have to do is stare at the flashing lights while you're dancing. And then your brain just shuts off. And later on, I found out that that's actually a trick that shamans use, it turns out. That's why fire is so common in...
Whirling dervishes,
yeah,
too.
Exactly, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Spin in order to have an altered state.
So many cultures use dancing as a way of getting really, really, really high, but naturally. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at me oddly. Did you not know that this could happen?
No, well, what you guys are discussing, I'm just like, is this like hypnotism or just...
It's kind of self-hypnotism, yeah.
Yeah, if you think about it, it's the same concept, only, you know, instead of hypnotizing yourself, you're smoking something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's the same idea of, you know, misconceptualizing yourself in another state. Like, you feel better by displacing yourself, displacing your mind.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, like, being in an altered state of some kind is not a bad thing. I mean, meditation mm-hmm. is an altered state.
Oh, no, I'm completely...
Jogger's high is an altered state.
Yeah, for sure.
Being woken up 2 hours before you're supposed to have been woken up is an altered state. Not a good one.
Intense beauty. An intense, beautiful scene. So a landscape or something. You're out a sunset. I had been in moments where, honest to God, that could lift me. A song
mm-hmm.
that's so incredible that I often say I think I could levitate.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it so carries you. Mm-hmm. You don't need a single other thing to affect that. That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So you shortchange yourself when you don't allow yourself to experience these others really enhancing moments
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
doesn't need a drug or a drink. It's as if we're saying we can't be profound, we can't be intense, we can't be moved unless we use something. Well, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
The world around us can move us.
Indeed. I'm just saying, you know, sometimes people like to look for the easy way because it's right in front of them.
Oh,
is
yeah.
it readily available? It's targeted marketing to, you know, communities, targeted communities, you know, for usage.
So mm-hmm. having used all those drugs, and I use just about everything,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell you for a fact, and I'm not joking when I say this, the high I've experienced in the moments that I'm discussing with you were better than any drug I ever took, and never will it compare. And I have used just about every drug you can possibly use. So, personal experience.
Yeah. The one of the many terms for this, and I looked this up for completely unrelated reasons, and I just have a good memory, it's called aesthetic piloerection. And that literally is, piloerection is your hair standing on end, and it's just from an artistic or an aesthetic experience. So music, usually they study music for this. There are people who can just listen to a song and not their bioscience. That's like the science fiction BS version of what I'm looking for. What is the
neurochemistry?
Yeah, there you go. The sort of like neurochemistry or the neuroimaging is consistent with drug use or orgasm. It depends on who you're studying and what you're looking at and what the imaging method you're using is. But there are people who study this professionally. All they do is they study people getting really high by looking at beautiful art or listening to a beautiful song. It's a thing. I was actually thinking about doing an episode on it one day because physical pleasure seeking for asexuals is a challenge. And so I thought that would be an interesting episode idea. If you're listening and you would like to see this happen, be sure to message us on our Twitter or Facebook. Always trying to get the audience participation in there.
That should be fun.
All right. So back to the... Oh, actually. Holy crow. We've only got 20 minutes left. Okay. Once you get going, it's always easy to lose track. Okay, so we're going to go to another song. I'm going to play an early Tegan and Sarah, because Luke loves playing Tegan and Sarah, but he loves playing the Dutch remixes.
Yeah,
so we're going to play one of the early ones, because as I said, for some reason I felt like playing folk music today. And it was one of their more well-known earlier ones, but not one that charted. And because this is public radio, we can't play things that chart.
Obviously.
Yeah. So, no, it's not because of being pretentious. It's actually in the CRTC.
Oh.
Yeah. It's supposed to be 35% Canadian content, and then anything that was a chart topper is kind of off the books, because there's other things that do that already.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's fair. You should just make like a list of like Luke's most hated songs.
And then play that?
Yeah. Yeah, I would do that. I'll be there for you.
So Luke is our other co-host, and he has his taste in music is hit and miss. When it's good, it's very good, but it's rarely good. Do you know what I mean? Okay, yeah. Knowing nods. Jake is agreeing too. Okay, so we're going to go to some early Tegan and Sarah, and we'll be right back.
Yourself clean, and I wonder why it is that they left this bathroom so unclean, so unlike me. I hope I never figure out who broke your heart.
Nice short song with banjo. I like banjo. So in the remaining 20 minutes, I would like to talk about the particular struggles of Pride. So Toronto's already happened. Montreal is, I think, next weekend. Either next weekend or... No, it is next weekend. And Ottawa Pride, Capital Pride, is coming up in 2.5 weeks now. And there is a particular history with Pride of overindulging, let's say. So I know that there's a huge challenge in the addiction recovery community, addictions and recovery community, actually, I should say, of attending Pride when, especially in the bigger cities, there's just everything is everywhere, and when you're walking down Church Street during Toronto Pride, everything smells like burning catnip, let's say. I don't know if you knew this, by the way, that it's an old trick from drug dealers in the 70s. They'd carry catnip on them because it smells identical when you burn it to marijuana. And so you get, like, a little paper bag of it, and if you're getting followed by the cops, you light it on fire and throw it down an alleyway. And then they go towards the smell. Anyway, unrelated.
That's a good trick.
Well, nobody cares anymore because Canada's going in the direction where the cops are like, eh, you're not causing trouble. But anyway, right, so Pride. CAPSA is involved with Pride. They have been for a couple of years now.
Yes. Yeah.
What do you know about this? What can you say?
Well, I know we've walked a couple of times in the parade. We had a float. It was great. It was nice to be part of that whole event. But I think the last year, I think, was the first time there was an offer to space. Mm-hmm. Where people could go after the parade, and it was a safe place for people in recovery. And this year, I understand that this is going to be a much larger environment with a stage of its own. So it's nice to see this growth.
Right.
Because I think it's so important, because this, again, is a serious problem for the population. Mm-hmm. And not to have that safe space, mm-hmm. I think, is a problem. How can you attend and feel okay? People in recovery, you know, they need to know that they're not going to be in the wrong environment. So they might have stayed away.
Yeah.
And now they actually can go in and really enjoy themselves. And I think it's incredible. I'm just thrilled, mm-hmm. personally.
Last year, it was called the Fresh Zone.
Yes.
And it was on, where was it? I know it was on Bank in the corner of McLaren, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm really bad with the downtown streets. They all kind of blur into each other. And I do remember seeing it last year. And if you were at Pride, you may have been in the Fresh Zone and not realized it. I remember there was DJs, and there was a bubble machine.
Yes.
And the bubble machine was on for like 6 hours straight or something like that. And there was kids everywhere. And I liked how it was advertised as being a CAPSA space, but it ended up becoming a family space.
Yes.
There's kids everywhere. It was great. And I think this year they're kind of aiming for the same thing, that it's not just like, oh, we'll shove the addicts over there so they stop complaining. Like, it's more than that. It's I mean, first of all, it is supportive. It's not about getting them to stop complaining. It's actually like, we want more people to come. And we want more people to feel more comfortable. We want to develop a safe space. But it's more than just addictions and recovery. And now families. So why is this important for everyone? Why is this not just for the addictions and recovery
community? Well, I think that, you know, for people like families specifically, when you're talking about families, the idea of attending an event where maybe the focus is on drinking and using a lot, mm-hmm. this doesn't feel like a safe place for your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we want, you know, certainly we'd want a place that would be open not only to people in recovery, but other people who want to be in a space that's not surrounded by using.
Mm-hmm. Where
they can feel like they can celebrate and enjoy as well. And I think it just makes some sense to create that space,
mm-hmm.
you know, to have both. For those who want to party and enjoy themselves and indulge, and mm-hmm. those who would feel safer, specifically around families, I would think, too, to have their children in a space where it's not being shared by people who are partying mm-hmm. in a more heavier sense.
Do you see a lot of children at Blues Fest, actually? Because I know they have beer tents at Blues Fest. I don't think there are a lot of kids there, are there?
No, there are some, but not. But you can look at Blues Fest, you can get space from people who are drinking. It's not hard to get up and move.
Okay.
So, I mean, I attend Blues Fest, and if it's too crazy around me, I just move to a different spot. And
right.
You can usually get away from it. But when an entire event really is focused on that party scene, mm-hmm. at some point, that becomes more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
I mean, it's the same thing as, you know, when you have a family members going out to support you, where the main, like you said, the main focus is drinking and smoking and substance abuse, then obviously it makes the addict feel, or the recovery feel a bit more comfortable, much more supported, And that just makes it a little bit more add to their confidence, I guess, and like the idea that they can get better.
And normalize it, really, because, mm-hmm. again, not everybody wishes to indulge in drug use or alcohol use. You know, like, I don't consider myself at great risk today. I just don't wish to be around it.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer not to have to be involved in that type of activity today. So I would like to have the choice, and I'm sure there are more people like me who aren't even people in recovery who would prefer to not be in an environment where everyone is using.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a normalization when you bring families in, too, because families, you know, want a healthy environment for their children to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it, you know, when you have, like, an environment where there are different generation with kids, parents, and then, you know, people who have sensitive problems or issues with society or substances, then you have all of that together on a float or a parade, and that makes it feel like a very safe space. And it is, because all those people have all those things in common. They're all vulnerable, and so
yes,
it's
exactly.
Great, make a great community.
And we're talking also about the inclusion of First Nations people,
mm-hmm.
and the Inuit. And again, this is a group that we like to see represented anywhere and everywhere. Is there part of an integral part of our community?
Yeah.
Certainly an integral part of the community of recovering people as well, because they have come from that traumatic past and suffered a lot with addiction issues. So again, wonderful to see them to be represented in that space as well.
I was actually trying to find the Pride Guide for this year, because I know it's been released. I've seen a copy of it, but I can't find it right now, partly because I have half my eye on the board and half my eye on the computer and half my brain listening to the conversation, so it's kind of hard to do everything at once. But anyway, so I can't look up the exact list of performing artists, but I do know that there are multiple First Nations performers this year. And I heard a rumor that originally A Tribe Called Quest had agreed to it, and then they realized they were double booked and had to back out. So I don't know if you're... No, not A Tribe Called Quest. A Tribe Called Red.
Right, yeah.
So if you're familiar with them at all, they run the Electric Powwow events here in Ottawa. And they're fantastic, by the way. My little 7-year-old nephew loves them. But I do know that the stage has a lot of First Nations performers, which is very exciting because... I mean, if you want to talk about a group that has been left out of other movements, they are definitely high on the list. And
we also want to mention Métis.
Oh, yes, for
well.
Sure.
They often get forgotten in that mix, and they are a huge part of our community as well.
And then there's the huge... What was it? I think it was a federal law that was passed a couple months ago that Métis are just Aboriginal, and that's just how it is, mm-hmm. which is yes, but no, but kind of yes, but mostly no. It's... Oh, we could talk about that for hours. What was I going to say? My brain just emptied.
Probably something about Amari. I swear to God, like whenever I look at you, and then my brain just go blank. Just like
there's a lot of things going on in here right now. A lot of flashing lights. Right. So I mean, because of that, I'm kind of personally tempted to go to the fresh zone, or the dry stage, as it would be called in other cities, if you're unfamiliar with the term fresh zone. Turns out fresh zone has a history. I had never heard of the term before last year. But
Sounds better.
It's yeah, definitely. But it sounds like a place to get fruit. I mean, I'm okay with that, because sometimes you just crave an orange. But yeah, some of the performers actually look really good. It's not like they put the A performers in the beer gardens and the B performers at the Fresh Zone. They really did mix them up. And I really wish I could find the list, because I remember when I saw it some time ago, I was very, very impressed by the diversity that was coming in. But yeah, so Pride has worked at making this safe space. And I think the community in general has been very supportive of it. So if you look at events in the community, for example, the Queer Mafia events and the, not Apartment 613, Queer 613, Queering 613 events, they have a lot of events at, well, and also actually, so there's other events planners as well in town. Can't remember any of them off the top of my head, because I know they're sachet, but they're definitely just in bars. But anyway, many of the other events organizers in town do have events outside of bars, or they have them in spaces like, I don't know, like the Atomic Rooster, or back when it was back before it had burnt down, the Daily Grind, which were cafes, which they're cafe restaurants that have alcohol available. And so there isn't, it's not like meeting at the Royal Oak where you know you're in a pub, where you know everyone's drinking. You go to somewhere that's a little bit more mixed and people feel more comfortable not getting a beer. And I've seen a lot more events like that popping up around town. So it's not, it isn't just some political thing that is going on in some corners of the community. It seems to be a growing thing.
We should offer a healthy alternative.
Yeah.
What about our youth?
Yeah.
You know, when the only option is the drink.
Yeah, exactly.
Why are we not offering them other environments where...
Also, I've noticed that if Public Service Pride does events during the week, they rarely do them at bars because they'll do a Saint-Cassette, for example. Mm-hmm. And if they do it at a bar, you don't see many people drinking because they have to go home and get up at... stupid o'clock in the morning to get to work the next day anyway. So it is becoming less of a drinking-oriented culture. It's still there, but I think that, like earlier when I said modesty doesn't really play into it, I think that's starting to become a thing where more people are comfortable saying, yes, but only a little bit, because I have something to do, or I don't want to... I have to get home, or, you know, I have to sober up in 2 hours so I can drive, or whatever. Like, you're seeing a lot more of that now. Relative to back when I first started going to Pride about 10 years ago now. So, I don't know. It's looking good. Do you feel comfortable at Pride?
I mean, I have only gone to Pride like a handful of times.
Mm-hmm.
So, most of the time I went to, I always feel, I wouldn't say compelled, but I would say like I would feel more comfortable either tipsy mm-hmm. or drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say that, you know, you have to be tipsy or drunk to be at Pride. But it just seemed like, you know, the environment to be in. But at the same time, if I was to say I would go there, I would feel safe, you know, sober from substance and mm-hmm. addiction. And so I would say, you know, it is most of the time, you know. So I don't know how to describe it. It's like you have, you know, this very family friendly, safe feeling.
Right.
And then, you know, but at the same time, it's also a culture where people drink and do drugs and stuff like that. So, you know, you know it's better, but it's not apparent. So you just have to, like, you know, dive into it.
Mm-hmm. But also just, I'm thinking, like, when I first met you, you were smoking maybe, like, 2 or 3 cigarettes a day. And
That's... Okay.
Or at least that I knew of. When you go to Pride, like, do you suddenly feel like lighting one off the other? Or is it, like, are you comfortable enough?
It's actually, yeah, that's actually a good point. Well, 1 to 3 a day would be, let's just say it's modest. But at the same time, when I'm walking around at Pride, you know, it's like it's something to do because a lot of people there also smoke. You know, I see a lot of people smoking and walking around having fun. It's like another thing that trigger for me. So, like, you know, it's just the environment and, you know, it's the activity that I do around there kind of make me feel a little bit more compelled to pull out a smoke, I suppose.
I feel like this is a conversation.
It could be. It could be.
But we are running out of time, so gonna sign off soon. First, I want to thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
This is a very big deal that we need definitely to have more conversations like this in the community. And thank you, Jake, for coming in and for blushing and being embarrassed when I mentioned you're smoking. Oh, he's blushing again.
Okay, thank you for embarrassing me on air.
Well, it's not easy to talk about, and it was... Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
You're creeping me out. I should just take a picture of that. Just go with a radio episode.
All right, so next week is going to be the first week that Luke is back in the country since almost a month ago. So, wait, he's going to be back for next Thursday, right?
He said he's coming back Saturday, I suppose.
Okay, yeah, see, there you go. It's going to be Luke's first time back in a while, and so he'll be back on air. And in the meantime, we're going to play off with some Tori Amos, because it occurred to me that I don't know if we have ever played Tori Amos on the show before. So we're going to play off with Taxi Ride, which is a good song that did not chart, but that's okay.
Does Luke hate it?
I don't know.
That's good to find out.
I don't know if he knows who Tori Amos is.
He probably hates it then.
Okay. Thank you for listening. This has been The Velvet Studio, and I'll see you next time. Ladies dance on.